content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. And now, from the fiction section of the July 4th, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine, To Sunland by Lauren Groff. He woke to an angry house and darkness in the windows. Aunt Maisie had packed his suitcase the night before and left it near the front door, and so he dressed himself without turning on the light and came out and dropped the pajamas on top of the suitcase. She was in the kitchen, banging the pans around. "Buddy," she said when she saw him, "set yourself down and get some of this food in you." Her eyes were funny, all red and puffy, and he didn't like to see them like that. When he sat down, she came up behind him and hugged his head so hard it hurt, and her hands smelled like soap and cigarettes and grease, and he pulled away. He ate her eggs, which were like his mother's eggs, though her biscuit was not like his mother's biscuit. It was too dry, and there was no tomato jam. When he was finished, she took his plate and fork and washed them. "I can't stand it," she said. "I will never forgive that girl, not as long as I live." "All right," he said softly. "I can't stay around to watch this," she said. "You get your shoes and coat on. I'm going into work early so I don't have to look at that selfish, wicked girl in the face." She gathered her own things and swiped a thin red line of lipstick on her mouth, and then took her car keys from the hook and went out the front door. There she bent to put his pajamas in his suitcase and said impatiently, "Come on outside, buddy. That rocking chair is comfortable enough for you to wait in, I wager. I'll get you a jelly jar full of water, and you need to relieve yourself. And get down off the porch and do it in the azaleas." Now he was outside in the darkness, and the smell of the orange blossoms was all around. The light above Aunt Maisie's front door was thick with termites that were flying in and out of the beam. Aunt Maisie came out again with water for Buddy and locked her front door. For a second, as she leaned toward the lock, in the dim light her hair was the same as his mother's hair, and he forgot and thought she was his mother, and he nearly cried out in gladness. Then she looked up at him, and it was with Aunt Maisie's face. The gladness died in him, and he began to cry. "Now don't you start blubbering," Aunt Maisie said. "You'll set me off again. Big like a man and 20 years old. But you're just a little old baby in your head, poor soul." "No, ma'am, I'm a man," he said, and wiped his face. Because he was much taller than her, she waited until he sat in the rocking chair, and then she leaned in and kissed him on the cheek. "You be good, buddy," she said. "Get down on your knees and pray every night like your mama taught you. Don't you be making no trouble, you hear?" "Yes, ma'am," he said. "I'll write you every week on Sunday and try to get myself up there to visit once a month or so, depending on my money. You know, I don't make barely enough for my own food, and besides, I'm getting old now, not doing so good myself these days. And, well, no more of that. In any event, don't forget there's a soul in the world that loves you." "That's right. Your Aunt Maisie loves you," she said.
"Yes, ma'am," he said.
She dug in her pocketbook and put a little note under the handle of his suitcase. "Now you be sure your sister sees that note whenever she turns up, you hear?" And she smiled, but it wasn't a real smile, really. "Yes, ma'am," he said, and began moving in the rocking chair as she went down the steps and into her car. The headlights were too bright for a minute, until she backed all the way out into the road and was gone. He did not feel the cold so much when he rocked, and he was soothed by the orange blossoms hiding out there in the darkness, the golden rain of termites, the noises of some night bird calling somewhere, the good rhythm of his rocking. It was nice to see the way the sky began to take on a pale line at its edge. Then pink began to grow out of the pale line and spun up and out, and he could see the orange groves out there coming clear in the new light. And then the sun rose full, and though he knew enough not to look at it for very long, he did look at it a little bit, and when he closed his eyes,
The sun shone in echoing red on its lids. Now the fog was lifting up from the ground under the trees, and an animal he didn't know the name of, shiny and hard-looking, with a long tail, moved slowly through the yard, sniffing at things. Then, all at once, there was Joni in the morning light in front of him, her own suitcase in her hand, and a little straw hat with a yellow band on her head. She had walked up without him seeing or hearing her. She was frowning a little. "Hey there, bud," she said. "Aunt Maisie isn't here with you? She left you out here all by your lonesome?" She jutted her chin at the house, and he turned to look, but there was no one there. Then she saw the note under the suitcase's handle and pulled it out and read it and gave a sharp little laugh. She balled the note up and threw it down on the worn rubber doormat. "She feels so dang strong about it, maybe she could have kept you herself," Joni said. "That old bat-faced shrew." She took a white handkerchief out of her pocketbook and spat on a corner, and then rubbed at his face where he still wore Aunt Maisie's kiss. "You ready to walk a bit?" she said. "Yes, Joni," he said, and stood and chuckled as the rocking chair rocked on without him in it. She took his suitcase in one hand and hers in the other and led him down the path to the soft, thick dirt of the road. They went for a long time through the stretch with laurel oak trees and palmettos on one side, the big plantation of orange trees on the other. It was early enough that there was some shade, and they kept to it. Joni seemed to be thinking about something and didn't talk, which was all right because he liked to watch her two braids snake back and forth across her back as she walked. When they got to the turnoff toward the fishing camp, she put the suitcases down with a sigh and shook out her hands. "At this rate," she said, "we're not going to make the noon bus." And then she looked at him where he stood and said, "Hey, wait, what am I thinking? You're pretty strong, right, buddy?" "Real strong," he said, and he picked up the suitcases as if they were nothing. They went on through the sunspots and the shade and were almost at the crossroads when a sound came from behind them, and a pickup barreled past in a big blow of dust. Then the truck stopped and blinked its back lights and reversed toward them. Joni swore under her breath and patted her hair, but was smiling when the driver rolled down his window. He was a red-faced man with eyes hidden under the brim of his cap. "Well, if it isn't Joni Green," the driver said. "In the flesh," she said, "and her big older brother, Buddy. How you doing, Mr. Summerlin? You're not going into town, are you? I like your new truck." "Well, looks like I am now," he said. "I was only driving around in my brand new baby just now, picked her up from the lot. She's a 56, last year's model, so I got her for a song. Anyways, since you've graduated, you know you can call me Harmon." "Well, thanks, Harmon," she said. "Saving us a long, hot walk." "Well, toss them suitcases in the back and climb up right next to me, girl," he said. "You and your brother, how's it going, buddy? I heard a bunch of rumors about you, but your mama kept you to her own self, didn't she?" "Yes, sir," Buddy said, and put the suitcases into the bed of the truck. "Speaking of which," the driver said as they climbed in and Joni reached across Buddy's lap to close the door, "I'm sorry for your loss, both of you." "Well, thank you," Joni said. "We didn't get along so great all the time, but it's still not easy to lose a mother." The truck started moving, and the wind felt so good on Buddy's cheeks that he closed his eyes. Joni told the driver how their mother had barely left them anything. The bank had come in and taken away the house, and Joni had to scramble to sell off everything before it was put out on the street. "Humiliating," she said. "All my mama's old lady friends haggling with me over little pieces of her embroidery, her clock, her teapot, like vultures. Trying to get as much out of me for as little money as possible." "Girl," the driver said, "you know that if you need help, all you got to do is ask. We can work something out." And he looked at Buddy out of the corner of his eye and slowly put one of his big red hands on Joni's knee. Joni laughed and didn't pull her knee away. "You're a good guy, Harmon," she said. "But you see, we got our suitcases. We're getting out of this old dump." "Where to?" he said. And she said, yes. Oh, he said, and looked across at Buddy. Something new came into his face, and he said, you taking him to the colony up in Gainesville? That place for the feeble-minded and epileptic? Well, well, isn't that something? Everybody always said how your mama should have done it years ago. I am, yeah, she said. I wrote away and got a letter back that they're holding a place for him. They started calling it something else, though. Sunland. Sounds softer. And you staying up there, Harmon said, getting yourself a job, becoming a real career girl? Nah, Joni said, and a little smile played on her lips, and she said, surely you remember how smart I am. Top of your class, he said, a whipcracker. Run rings around the rednecks in this place. Well, anyways, last year I applied to all the ladies' colleges up north, and I got my pick. Took the one that gave me a full scholarship up there in Maine. And then my mama got sick, and they let me defer and come for the spring semester. Got me a train ticket and $100 bill and just a little more to get me there and set up with books before school starts in about a week. Jesus, Maine, he said, practically the North Pole. You're going to freeze your little Florida fanny off, girl. Well, that's the idea, she said. Give me igloos and whale blubber, and I'll go to another planet if I could. Well, congratulations, Harmon said, and his hand slid a little further up her thigh, and some of his fingers disappeared under her skirt. You know, I heard about you, Joni Green. I know some people around here will be missing you sorely. She pushed his hand back down to her knee and said, oh, Harmon, come on now. They were nearing the barn at the edge of town that had a life-size plaster bull on its roof, and Buddy leaned forward eagerly and put his finger on the windshield and shouted out, bull! The other two laughed, and Joni said, yeah, Buddy, that's a bull. And she took Buddy's big hand in her small one and squeezed it. Hey, listen, the driver said, too quickly as they came close to the bus station. You got some time before the bus leaves. Maybe we can drop Buddy off to sit for a spell on a bench there, and you and me can drive somewhere for a little chat. Give you a goodbye to remember. Make you think of your old hometown in a positive light when you're up there in Maine. Joni didn't lose her smile, but it went tight, and she said, nah, thanks for the offer, but we don't have all that much time. The truck stopped, and she leaned over Buddy and opened the door and pushed him out. Grab them suitcases, bud, she said in a low voice, and then she went around to the driver's window and murmured there for a bit. Buddy watched from the shade as the pleasantness fell off the driver's face, and he began to look red and then angry, and then he pulled out his wallet and handed over some bills to Joni, who tucked them into her pocketbook. The driver threw the pickup into reverse and drove away far too fast, spitting dust up all over them again. Never coming back to this old snake pit again, she said. Might as well make a little money setting fire to all my bridges. Still can't believe they let that old lecher work at the high school. She sighed and smacked dust off her skirt and blouse and hat and said, anyways, we got about a half hour. What do you say we go get ourselves a milkshake? And she led Buddy into the drugstore where their mother used to take him for lunch after church on Sundays. There was nobody in the drugstore besides the boy in the paper cap behind the counter, who flushed when he saw Joni come in. Hey there, buddy, he called out in a strange, strained voice. You here for your usual burger chocolate malted? Oh, yes, please, Buddy said, putting down the suitcases and sitting on a stool. His stomach rumbled loudly. Hey there, Joni, the boy said, flicking his eyes at her. Haven't seen you for a spell. You doing good? You looking good? Well, I'm an orphan now, so not so good, I guess, she said dryly. Ah, jeez. Oh, boy, the boy said, and his blush became almost purple. I'm so sorry, Joni. I didn't know. Was wondering why your mama didn't bring Buddy in here this last month or so. Ah, man, I'm such a pumpkinhead. Listen, I'll make it up to you. I'll buy you lunch. It's on me. Well, it's on Mr. Katz, who owns the place, but he'll never know. And the boy winked and turned away and began fiddling with the grill, shaking his head once in a while and hissing under his breath at his own stupidity. Joni smiled to herself then, but every time the boy stole a glance at her, she put a sad expression on her face. Buddy looked at himself in the mirror behind the syrups. He liked his dark hair and dark eyes, but he did not like the dust that was in his hair. It kept being a surprise to him that it was Joni next to him in the mirror, carefully shaking the dirt out of her clothing and her hair and dabbing at her face with a paper napkin, and not his mother. Every time, the surprise turned to pain. The boy in the paper hat delivered 2 maltids, 2 burgers, and 2 fries, and hovered as they ate. Buddy was so hungry he barely chewed, and Joni ate delicately, touching the corners of her mouth with her napkin after every bite. When Buddy was done, he looked at her food so hard that she pushed it over to him.
"Wasn't good?" the boy said anxiously. "You didn't like it, Joni?"
"Don't you fret," Joni said. "It was wonderful. I just haven't been eating much recently, and it takes only a few bites to fill me up."
"Nice to hear you thought it was good," the boy said.
But then the bells above the door jingled, and an old couple, arm in arm, came in and sat down on the stools. He rolled his eyes and went over with his little pad of paper to take their order. Buddy finished all the food. Joni wiped his face and hands, and she slid off the stool and dug into her pocketbook for a quarter. And then she reconsidered, replaced the quarter, and put a dime on the counter. "Let's go," she said to Buddy. But they hadn't gone more than a few steps before the boy rushed back to where they'd sat and said,
"Hey, Joni, hey, Joni, wait a second. Do you maybe want to go out with me one of these days? I can borrow my brother's car, and we'll go for a drive, maybe get some dinner, maybe, or go bowling or fishing or something."
Joni turned around with a broad smile on her face and said, "Oh, I'd love that, truly. Why don't you just call my Aunt Maisie's house for a date? She don't like me going out with boys, so she'll try to tell you I don't live there, but don't you listen. Just keep calling, and one day you'll get me, not her."
"Oh, great, Joni," the boy said. "I'll do that. I'll just keep calling for you."
"You do that," she said. And she and Buddy went outside, and Joni laughed as they crossed the road.
"Oh, boy," she said. "Maisie's going to get so mad."
"Yes," Buddy said, and laughed. Not because he understood, but because his sister was laughing, and the sound made him happy. But soon he saw that something was wrong, and he stopped and put down the suitcase. "Home is this way," he said slowly, pointing down the street full of dusty magnolias. "Church this way," he said, pointing at the big red brick church on the corner. Joni shaded her eyes and looked at him and said gently,
"We're not going to church or home, Bud. We're off on a bus to Gainesville."
"Oh," he said, "I don't know that place."
"Me neither," she said. "Well, we lived up there when we was real little, but when Daddy left Mama, so sudden, she took a strong dislike to the place and brought us down to this dumb little nothing town."
"I want Mama," Buddy said, and began to cry.
"Ah, none of that, Buddy," she said. "None of that right now. Big old boy blubbering in the street. As if it's not hard enough as it is."
And she put the suitcase back in his hand and took his other hand and pulled him through the parking lot to where the bus was already grumbling and people were slowly climbing into it. The bus was broiling hot, and they had to go halfway back to find a seat, but Joni said it'd be cool once they were moving and wind came through the windows. She parked their suitcases on their laps because, she said in a whisper,
"You can't trust none of the people who ride buses. All the people you can trust already have their own cars and wouldn't be caught dead in a bus." "Someday," she said dreamily, "she was going to buy herself a great big car, pearly colored with leather so soft inside you'd think you were riding along in a cool white bed."
But Buddy wasn't listening, because among the people getting on the bus was a woman with a great puff of red hair under a very tiny hat. And in one hand, she held a blue suitcase, and in the other, a golden cage with two crested cockatiels in it. She was heavy and gasping, and she stopped for a minute at the seat opposite Buddy and Joni's, and then scanned her options and sighed, and put the cage next to the window and settled herself down. The driver came on and took people's quarters. Joni cursed under her breath, but opened her little pocketbook and dug around for change.
"Bleeding me dry," she said to Buddy. "Guess I won't be eating until I get to Maine."
The lady across the way overheard her and said,
"Maine? You two running off to Maine? I come up on this bus and I see you here and I think, look at that handsome boy and that pretty girl. I bet they're sweethearts running off together. How romantic. And I says to myself, Ada Severin, you sit yourself down right next to them there. See if you can't get their story. Maybe you know their people, but then the closer up to you I get, the more I see that no, they're not sweethearts. Not at all. Maybe they're brother and sister. There's a family resemblance around the eyes, and then by the time I get here, I see clear that there's something funny going on with that handsome boy right there. Maybe something not quite right up in his brain."
"Don't you say that. Everything's just perfect in his brain," Joni said sharply. "He's all angels and rainbows up there. His gears are just a little slower than most."
"In any event," the lady said with a chesty sort of laugh, "not often that I'm wrong. Blessed Jesus has bestowed upon me the power of perception. I always had it, I guess you'd say, but it got sharpened when I started reading them Sherlock Holmes books in the library. What you do is you look real hard at a person and see all the little things and then put them together. Like the bus driver has those deep scars on his hands. Do you see him? I bet he was a turpentine cutter up in the pines for a long while, but he has a little hitch in his walk, and I bet an accident happened, and that's why he started driving buses."
"Maybe so," Tony said. "Maybe not."
"Say," the lady said in an excited voice, "he's coming back this way. Let's see if I'm right."
And she said to the bus driver,
"Pardon me, but we got a little wager going on that you used to be a turpentine cutter up in them pines once upon a time."
The driver stopped in the aisle and looked down at the lady's face for a long moment. At last he said gravely, "I don't believe I know you, ma'am," and kept going to his seat at the front.
"See," the lady crowed, "told you."
"Well, that was neither confirmation nor denial," Joni said. "I think he gave you the old mind your own beeswax."
"Dear no, I saw the confirmation plain as day there in his face," the lady said. "In any event, smells like someone around here's been eating onions recently. The Lord has blessed me with a powerful nose. Can smell near on anything, and there's nothing worse than riding 4 hours on a bus with someone who's been eating onions."
And she opened up her very tiny purse and took out a tin, pulled the top off, delicately lifted away the paper with the tip of her finger to reveal pale little lozenges inside.
"Violet candy?" she offered.
And since Joni and Buddy had both eaten onions on their burgers, they took one candy apiece.
"Tastes like licking a plaster wall," Joni said, making a face. "Well, you're welcome," the lady said. "Took me a minute, but my perceptions about you sure did come clear at last," the lady said.
"Oh, yeah?" Joni said. "Yeah, I can see you're dumping your brother at that farm colony up in Gainesville and going on alone to Maine because you got a job there."
The lady squinted, looked at Joni's shoes, her hands, her hair, her straw hat, and said,
"I don't know, shopkeeper? No, I got it. Lady's companion."
Something struggled in Joni, but at last she said with a smile she tried to bite down.
"Almost. Women's college."
"College girl? Well, I'll be," the lady said.
"I myself begged and begged to go to college, but my daddy said no. Not even a Christian college. Not even a home economics course. Ada, honey, no amount of book reading can make a woman a better housekeeper," he always said to me. "But, of course, that was a different time before the First Great War, before women even got to vote, and
then got all uppity and started yelling for things. Well, to tell you the truth, I'm mighty envious of you going off to college. I would have loved to learn about the old books and the philosophers and such. Though I say, I always do say, a woman's place is in the home. And she said this with such a vehemence, her chins wobbled. One of the birds in the cage was sleeping, and the other was puffed up and preening under its wings. It stopped when it saw Buddy staring at it and shouted out, "Red Peril! Red Peril!" The lady laughed. "Oh, it just tickles me no end when he says that," she said. "I taught him that myself. It's what all the boys used to call me back in the day. Not because I'm one of them communists, of course. Of course not, but because of my hair." And she fluffed her hair with one plump hand and said, "Red Peril. I know you can't see it, but I used to be pretty as you, my girl." "Well, I believe it if you say it," Joni said. The bus had started moving through the long yellow afternoon, and the air blowing through the windows came as a great relief. In any event, the lady said, "College girl, let's see if you got the power of perception like me. Bet you can't take a look at me and tell my story the way I did with the bus driver and you." "All right," Tony said, and she put on a very serious face and looked the woman over slowly and so hard that her eyes began to cross. At last, in a spooky voice, she said, "You teach piano up in Gainesville. You come down here for a week every year to visit your sister, but couldn't leave your birds behind because you're a spinster and you live all alone in your little apartment up there. You and your sister don't get along at all because of the bad blood between you. Your sister's still mad, deep down, that your daddy left the house up in town to you when he died, and all she got was a bunch of fields full of nothing down in these parts. You spent the whole week playing solitaire in different rooms and quarreling over what you wanted to eat for supper." The lady gaped at Joni, her little eyes blinking fast. At last she said, "Bless me! I'm a widow, not a spinster, but besides that, you're dead on. You're a natural, just like me." Joni laughed and said, "Nah, my mama used to clean the house for your sister's neighbor, old Mr. Hubbard. Your sister would complain about your visits for weeks before you came down." "Oh, what a dirty trick," the lady cried out, her cheeks turning red. "How unchristian of you. But I don't know what I should have expected from a girl who's throwing away her own brother like he's trash." And then she turned her face indignantly toward the front of the bus and bellowed for all to hear, "A friend loveth at all times, and a brother is born for adversity." Proverbs. "I'm 17, lady," Joni said angrily. "How the heck can I take care of a big old jug of molasses like him? Anyways, I was just having a little fun," Joni said in a sweeter voice. But the lady had set her angry face toward her birds and her own window, where Florida was rushing by. Joni lowered her face to Buddy's shoulder and tried to muffle her laughter. Soon, though, she just rested her head there, and her eyes slowly closed, and she fell asleep. After some time, the lady with the birds extracted a peeled, hard-boiled egg from her bag, opened a sheet of paper carefully, and dipped every bit of the white of the egg into the salt and pepper there. Buddy liked the way the lady ate the egg, in tiny, fast bites, leaving the golden center for the end, which she rolled in the last of the salt and pepper and let it sit in her mouth until it dissolved. And then she, too, fell asleep. And her snores, high in her nose, rose up and down in the air of the bus. Buddy liked everything about the bus right now, the feel of his sister's head on his shoulder and the smell of her hair, the way that the bumps in the road made the flesh of the woman with the birds jiggle, the way that the birds swayed inside the cage on their strange, sharp feet and bobbed their pretty crests and let their eyes go to slits. Through the window, when he let his eyes unfocus, The desperate, scrabbling cypresses with their feet in the water became a blur of gray and shining brown, and the palmetto spun a green weave. They stopped at each little town along the way. But when the bus picked up speed again, everything flashed gold and green and brown and blue over and over, and the sun began to lower itself, and upon his hands the hot yellow sunlight of late afternoon began to spread. It was then that something caught Buddy's attention. Rather, it was the lack of something, for the bird lady's high snoring had stopped, and a strange silence had overtaken the bus. He turned his head to look at the bird lady. She was wearing a serious face and leaning into the aisle. Now he saw that she was leaning over his sister's pocketbook, which, though the strap was still slung across her shoulder, had fallen off her lap and into the aisle. He saw the lady put her hand inside the pocketbook. Slowly, she pulled the roll of cash from it and held it in her hand, smiling. But then she looked up and saw Buddy watching her. Her face flushed, and she blinked her eyes fast and licked her lips. Then she peeled a bill away from the roll and shoved the rest back into the pocketbook and closed the clasp with nimble fingers.
"Just having a little joke," she whispered. "It's just some fun, no harm," she said, and
tucked the bill she had taken down the neck of her blouse. She put a finger to her lips and went, "Shh." "Joni," Buddy said, shaking his sister.
"Hush now, don't wake her," the lady said. "Poor girl looks awful tired and she needs a rest."
She took the paper bag of food that was squeezed between herself and the birdcage and tried to hand it to him.
"I got some nice ham sandwiches in there for you," she said coaxingly. "I don't even like ham, but my sister made me take them. There's some pecan sandies in there, too. You like cookies? Everyone likes cookies."
"Joni," he said, but was distracted by the smell of the ham from the bag that the lady had dropped on his lap.
"Anyways," the lady said, "she won't miss it in the long run. Pretty girl like her can always find a way to make a little money."
And she smiled, and there was lipstick all over her large front teeth. "Hey, Joni," Buddy said with less conviction now, but his sister was sleeping hard, and it took him a while to awaken her, and the bus was slowing, turning, and when she finally opened her eyes and wiped her mouth, they had stopped at the station, and he had forgotten what he wanted to tell her. Before the bus even came to a halt, the bird lady had stood and pushed her way down the aisle with her cage and her suitcase so that she would be the first off, ahead of all the people who sat in the front of the bus.
"Let me tell you," Joni said, smoothing down her hair, which the air through the windows had ruffled, and
looking at the lady who stood there so large at the front of the bus.
"Busybodies, like that nasty old thing, I certainly will not be missing up in Maine. From what I hear, them Yankees keep to themselves, as well they should."
They came off the bus into the long shadows of afternoon, the high spiky palm trees and the heritage oaks broad and dripping with moss. They took turns using the facilities at the bus station. While Buddy was waiting outside with the suitcases and Joni was inside the restroom, there came a terrible shriek and she ran out without even washing her hands.
"It's gone," she said. "It's gone. I looked in my pocketbook for a comb and my $100 bill is gone. I'm never going to be able to buy my books and such now."
And she sat down on her suitcase and screamed low into her hands. Buddy sat beside her on his own suitcase and put his arm around her and began to cry because he missed his mother so. There were other people in the station walking around, but nobody bothered them. At last, Joni stopped screaming into her hands and got up and went back into the bathroom to wash her face. And when she came out, she seemed somehow smaller, and her face was blotchy but set.
"What's that?"
she said, seeing the paper bag of food on his lap. "Bird lady gave it to me," he said. She opened the bag and whistled.
"Enough food here for days," she said.
She looked at him.
"They'll be feeding you where you're going. 3 square," they said. "You mind if I take this, bud? It'll feed me all the way until I get where I'm going.
And she didn't wait to hear what he said, but just packed it into her suitcase. "Ham in there," he said, sadly, his stomach feeling empty. "And cookies." "Well, we got about a mile to walk," she said. "You still feeling pretty strong, buddy?" she said. "Real strong," Buddy said, and took both of the suitcases and set off again, following his sister through the late afternoon. Buddy liked the neighborhoods they were walking through, the big wooden houses with their porches, all the people out walking their dogs. There were young people, too, in twos and threes, and when Joni watched them, something that had died in her face back at the station came alive again. "Bet they're students up at the university," she murmured. "Bet they're out here because their brains are too stuffed with symphonies and history and classical Greek, and they got to walk it all out to be able to sleep at night." And she smiled at Buddy and said kindly, "In some ways, you're going off to your kind of college, too, I guess." There was still light in the air when they crossed the big road and saw the sign. The name change was so recent that the blasted old board with Florida Farm Colony for Epileptic and Mentally Deficient Children still hung on the left, while on the right there was a fresh-painted sign that said, "Sunland." "Sunland," Joni said. "That's right. That's what they're calling it now. Doesn't that sound nice, Buddy? A land of sun." "That's where Mama's at, Joni," Buddy said, and Joni looked at him, and her whole body started to shake. "No, baby," she said, "Mama's not there." Then she said soft and fast to herself, "Oh, my God, what am I doing? What am I doing? Mama always said she had me to take care of you in case something happened to her, and look what I'm doing." But Buddy had turned eagerly toward the place and was now walking fast up to the gate where the guard was snoozing in his hut, a little transistor radio playing beside him. "Wait, Buddy," Joni called out behind him.
"You must be Robert, ain't you, boy?" the guard said. "I was beginning to despair for you. They said you was coming today, but it's near time to lock the gates, and here you are." "Here I am," Buddy said. "I'm Buddy." 15 more minutes and you would have had to find a place to stay for the night. Come back in the morning," guard said to Joni.
"I'm sorry, sir," she said. She was pale all over, even in her lips.
The guard spoke into his walkie-talkie, and a garbled sound came back out. Through the gate, they could see straight lines of sago palms and oleanders, lights on in the windows of the great, plain, white wooden buildings scattered around on the sparse grass. Buddy grasped the gate and pressed his face painfully between the metal bars to look harder. One of the doors of the closest building opened, and out of it three figures in white appeared and began to descend the stairs, shining backlit in the warm light that poured out from inside and painted the grass and the trees framing the building with gold. "Oh," Buddy breathed, because the sight was beautiful to him.
"Bud, listen to me," Joni said quickly beside him. "I'll come back for you. I'll get my education, and then I'll get my job, and when I have enough money to support us both, I'll come back to get you. Oh, Lord, forgive me."
But Buddy wasn't listening. He was watching the three stout women in white coming closer to him across the path. From this distance, he couldn't see their faces. Any one of them could be his mama. The early moon hung in the blue of the end of the day above, and, in the distance, a cat darted swiftly across the grounds. And Joni, who smelled like sweat and onions and like herself, rose up on her toes and kissed his cheek. The evening breeze lifted from across the farm fields with its warm smell of cows and dirt and touched him on his face and hands and neck. And in the smell there was something wilder, something off the wet and teeming prairie a few miles away, with its dark, terrible beasts below the water, the delicate, angelic birds on their long, thin legs above. In this moment, something inside him that was always singing, that nobody else could hear, sang louder, sang until the women came so close that at last they showed their faces. And then Joni, whom he looked at, trying to understand, turned her own face from him and began to walk away, fast, and did not look back. And now a comment from the July 4th, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine. We're not going back to the time before Roe. We're going somewhere worse. We are entering an era not just of unsafe abortions, but of the widespread criminalization of pregnancy. By Gia Tolentino. In the weeks since a draft of the Supreme Court's decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, a case about a Mississippi law that bans abortion after 15 weeks, with some health-related exceptions, but none for rape or incest, was leaked, a slogan has been revived, "We won't go back." It has been chanted at marches defiantly, but also somewhat awkwardly, given that this is a plainly an era of repression and regression in which abortion rights are not the only rights disappearing. Now that the Supreme Court has issued its final decision, overturning Roe v. Wade and removing the constitutional right to abortion, ensuring that abortion will become illegal or highly restricted in 20 states, the slogan sounds almost divorced from reality, an indication, perhaps, of how difficult it has become to comprehend the power and the right-wing extremism of the current Supreme Court. Support for abortion has never been higher, with more than two-thirds of Americans in favor of retaining Roe and 57% affirming a woman's right to abortion for any reason. Even so, there are Republican officials who have made it clear that they will attempt to pass a federal ban on abortion if and when they control both chambers of Congress and the presidency. Anyone who can get pregnant must now face the reality that half the country is in the hands of legislators who believe that your personhood and autonomy are conditional, who believe that if you are impregnated by another person under any circumstance, you have a legal and moral duty to undergo pregnancy, delivery, and, in all likelihood, 2 decades of or more of caregiving, no matter the permanent and potentially devastating consequences for your body, your heart, your mind, your family, your ability to put food on the table, your plans, your aspirations, your life. We won't go back. It's an inadequate rallying cry prompted only by events that belie its message. But it is true in at least one sense. The future that we now inhabit will not resemble the past before Roe, when women sought out illegal abortions and not infrequently found death. The principal danger now lies elsewhere and arguably reaches further. We have entered an era not of unsafe abortion, but of widespread state surveillance and criminalization of pregnant women, certainly, but also of doctors and pharmacists and clinic staffers and volunteers and friends and family members, of anyone who comes into meaningful contact with a pregnancy that does not end in a healthy birth. Those who argue that this decision won't actually change things much, an instinct you'll find on both sides of the political divide, are blind to the ways in which state-level anti-abortion crusades have already turned pregnancy into punishment, and the ways in which the situation is poised to become much worse. In the states where abortion has been or will soon be banned, any pregnancy loss past an early cutoff can now potentially be investigated as a crime. Search histories, browsing histories, text messages, location data, payment data, information from period tracking apps. Prosecutors can examine all of it if they believe that the loss of pregnancy may have been deliberate. Even if prosecutors fail to prove that an abortion took place, those who are investigated will be punished by the process, liable for whatever might be found. 5 years ago, Latice Fisher, a black mother of three from Mississippi who made $11 an hour as a police radio operator, experienced a stillbirth at roughly 36 weeks at home. When questioned, she acknowledged that she didn't want more kids and couldn't afford to take care of more kids. She surrendered her phone to investigators who scraped it for search data and found search terms regarding mifepristone and misoprostol, i.e. abortion pills.
These pills are among the reasons that we are not going back to the era of coat hangers. They can be prescribed via telemedicine and delivered via mail. Allowing for the prescription of an extra dose, they are 95 to 98% effective in cases of pregnancy up to 11 weeks, which account for almost 90% of all abortions in the United States. Already, more than half of all abortions in the country are medication abortions. In 19 states, doctors are prohibited from providing abortions via telemedicine, but women can seek help from clinicians in other states and abroad, such as Rebecca Gompertz, who leads Aid Access, an organization based in Austria, that is openly providing abortion pills to women in prohibition states and has been safely mailing abortion pills to pregnant people all over the world since 2005 with the organization Women on Web. In advance of the U.S. bans, Gompertz has been promoting advanced prescription. Sympathetic doctors might prescribe abortion pills for any menstruating person, removing some of the fears and possibly the traceability that would come with attempting to get the pills after pregnancy. Misoprostol can be prescribed for other issues such as stomach ulcers, and Gompertz argues that there is no reasonable medical argument against advanced prescription. If you buy bleach in the supermarket, that's more dangerous, she has said. There was no evidence that Latisse Fisher took an abortion pill. She maintained that she had experienced a stillbirth, an occurrence in one out of every 160 pregnancies in the United States. Nonetheless, she was charged with second-degree murder and held for several weeks on a $100,000 bond. The district attorney, Scott Colum, had campaigned as a progressive reformer. Advocates pushed him to drop the murder charge and to provide a new grand jury with information about an antiquated, unreliable float test that had been used as a basis for the allegation that Fisher's baby was born alive. The grand jury declined to indict Fisher again. The ordeal took more than 3 years. Even if it remains possible in prohibition states to order abortion pills, doing so will be unlawful. Missouri recently proposed classifying the delivery or shipment of these pills as drug trafficking. Louisiana just passed a law that makes mailing abortion pills to a resident of the state a criminal offense, punishable by 6 months imprisonment. In many states, to avoid breaking the law, a woman would have to drive to a state where abortion is legal, have a telemedicine consultation there, and then receive the pills in that state. Many women in Texas have opted for a riskier but easier option, to drive across the border to Mexico and get abortion pills from unregulated pharmacies where pharmacists may issue incorrect advice for usage. Some women who lack the freedom and money to travel out of state and who might fear the consequences of seeking a clinical confirmation of their gestational stage will order abortion pills without a clear understanding of how far along they are in pregnancy. Abortion pills are safe and effective, but patients need access to clinical guidance and follow-up care. Women in prohibition states who want to seek medical attention after a self-managed abortion will, as a rule, have to choose between risking their freedom and risking their health. Both abortion and miscarriage currently occur more than a million times each year in America, and the two events are often clearly indistinguishable. Because of this, prohibition states will have a profoundly invasive interest in differentiating between them. Some have already laid the groundwork for establishing government databases of pregnant women likely to seek abortions. Last year, Arkansas passed a law called the Every Mom Matters Act, which requires women considering abortion to call a state hotline and requires abortion providers to register all patients in a database with a unique ID. Since then, six other states have implemented or proposed similar laws. The hotlines are provided by crisis pregnancy centers, typically Christian organizations, many of which masquerade as abortion clinics, provide no health care, and passionately counsel women against abortion. Crisis pregnancy centers are already three times as numerous as abortion clinics in the U.S., and unlike hospitals, they are not required to protect the privacy of those who come to them. For years, conservative states have been redirecting money, often from funds earmarked for poor women and children, toward these organizations.
The data that crisis pregnancy centers are capable of collecting, names, locations, family details, sexual and medical histories, non-diagnostic ultrasound images, can now be deployed against those who seek their help. If you become pregnant, your phone generally knows before many of your friends do. The entire internet economy is built on meticulous user tracking of purchases and search terms. Laws modeled on Texas's SB 8, which encourages private citizens to file lawsuits against anyone who facilitates an abortion, will proliferate, giving self-appointed vigilantes no shortage of tools to track and identify suspects. The National Right to Life Committee recently published policy recommendations for anti-abortion states that included criminal penalties for anyone who provides information about self-managed abortion over the telephone, the internet, or any other medium of communication. A reporter for Vice recently spent a mere $160 to purchase a data set on visits to more than 600 Planned Parenthood clinics. Brokers sell data that make it possible to track journeys to and from any location, say an abortion clinic in another state. In Missouri, this year, a lawmaker proposed a measure that would allow private citizens to sue anyone who helps a resident of the state get an abortion elsewhere. As with SB 8, the law would reward successful plaintiffs with $10,000. The closest analog to this kind of legislation is the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793. For now, the targets of SB 8 type bounty laws are those who provide abortions, not those who seek them. But that seems likely to change. Connecticut, a progressive state on the matter of abortion, recently passed a law that prevents local agencies from cooperating with out-of-state abortion prosecutions and protects the medical records of out-of-state clients. Other progressive states will follow suit. If prohibition states can't sue out-of-state doctors, and if abortion pills sent by mail remain largely undetectable, the only people left to target will be abortion advocates and those trying to get abortions. The Stream, a conservative Christian publication, recently advocated mandatory psychiatric custody for women who get abortions. In May, Louisiana advanced a bill that would allow abortion patients to be charged with murder. The proposal was withdrawn, but the threat had been made. The theological concept of fetal personhood, the idea that from the moment of conception, an embryo or fetus is a full human being, deserving of equal, or more accurately, superior rights, is a foundational doctrine of the anti-abortion movement. The legal ramifications of this idea, including the possible classification of IVF, IUDs, and the morning after pill as instruments of murder, are unhinged and much harsher than what even the average anti-abortion American is currently willing to embrace. Nonetheless, the anti-abortion movement is now openly pushing for fetal personhood to become the foundation of U.S. abortion law. If a fetus is a person, then a legal framework can be invented to require someone who has one living inside her to do everything in her power to protect it, including, as happened to Savita Halappanavar in Ireland, which operated under a fetal personhood doctrine until 2018, and to Isabella Sajbor in Poland, where all abortion is effectively illegal, to die. No other such obligation exists anywhere in our society, which grants cops the freedom to stand by as children are murdered behind an unlocked door. In Poland, pregnant women with cancer have been routinely denied chemotherapy because of clinicians' fears of harming the fetus. Fetal personhood laws have passed in Georgia and Alabama, and they are no longer likely to be found unconstitutional. Such laws justify a full-scale criminalization of pregnancy, whereby women can be arrested, detained, and otherwise placed under state intervention for taking actions perceived to be potentially harmful to a fetus. This approach has been steadily tested on low-income minorities in particular for the past four decades. National Advocates for Pregnant Women, the organization that has provided legal defense for most of the cases mentioned in this article, has documented almost 1,800 cases from 1973 to 2020 of prosecutions or forced interventions related to pregnancy. This is likely a substantial undercount. even in states such as California, where the law explicitly prohibits charging women with murder after a pregnancy loss, conservative prosecutors are doing so anyway. Half a century ago, the anti-abortion movement was dominated by progressive, anti-war, pro-welfare Catholics. Today, the movement is conservative, evangelical, and absolutely single-minded, populated overwhelmingly by people who, although they may embrace foster care, adoption, and various forms of private ministry, show no interest in pushing for public, structural support for human life once it's left the womb. The scholar Mary Ziegler recently noted that today's anti-abortion advocates see the, quote, strategies of earlier decades as apologetic, cowardly, and counterproductive, end quote. During the past 4 years, 11 states have passed abortion bans that contain no exceptions for rape or incest, a previously unthinkable extreme. In Texas, already, children aged 9, 10, and 11 who don't yet understand what sex and abuse are face forced pregnancy and childbirth after being raped. Women sitting in emergency rooms in the midst of miscarriages are being denied treatment for sepsis because their fetuses' hearts haven't yet stopped. People you'll never hear of will spend the rest of their lives trying and failing agonizingly in this punitive country to provide stability for a first or fifth child they knew they weren't equipped to care for. In the face of all this, there has been so much squeamishness, even in the pro-choice camp, a tone that casts abortion as an unfortunate necessity, an approach to messaging which values choice but devalues abortion care itself, which emphasizes reproductive rights rather than reproductive justice. The approach has landed us here. We are not going back to the pre-Roe era, and we should not want to go back to the era that succeeded it, which was less bitter than the present, but was never good enough. We should demand more, and we will have to. We will need to be full-throated and unconditional about abortion as a necessary precondition to justice and equal rights if we want even a chance of someday getting somewhere better. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.